This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is King County Elections Director Julie Wise, probably the busiest person in the county now. Do you ever wake up terrified? I mean, you've got, what, a potential 1.5 million ballots to count. You can't make a mistake. What does that feel like?
Actually, it's extremely exciting. I've dedicated my career and life to the profession of election administration over the last 20 years. And to see over 50% of our voters having already returned their ballot here in King County, I am all excitement over here. So no terror, just excitement.
Okay, so this means that on election night, when you do that first ballot release, we should have some pretty significant results, right?
We're going to have some really meaningful results come election night, that first results posting. Of course, we're going to continue to count ballots and post at 4 p.m. every day until we certify the election, which is November 24th. But the more that voters return their ballot this week, just the more meaningful results we're going to have on election night. So we really know where those close races stand. We anticipate being released through the bulk of ballots by the Friday of election week, so next week.
Well, that's pretty impressive. But you were prepared for this, right? I mean, we knew there was going to be a lot of energy surrounding this election.
Certainly. We've been preparing for this presidential election for years. King County has taken a lot of initiatives to make sure that our voters have access while we safeguard the election system. So from things from prepaid postage to more drop boxes than the county and state have ever seen, we're seeing voters show up in record numbers here in King County and Washington State.
I was looking at the ballot boxes in Texas where they have exactly one per county. How many does King County have?
King County currently has 73 ballot drop boxes. And that serves 96% of our voters have a drop box within just a 3-mile radius of their home. And when you look at urban dense areas like the city of Seattle, that distance becomes even shorter. So 76% of voters in Seattle have a drop box within just a 1-mile radius. We have seen hundreds of thousands of ballots already returned to those ballot drop boxes. People really appreciate that service and then love going onto our website, tracking their ballot to ensure that it's gotten back into the elections office hands.
Right. You can do that. I did that, and it works. Okay, so we're seeing epic numbers of ballot returns this early in the process, which is great. What about the number of people who have registered to vote? Have you seen an increase in registrations, and especially you allow same-day registration, I know, but have you seen a push by more people to get registered?
Absolutely. In fact, King County has grown by 120,000 voters just in the last year ahead of this presidential election. Wow. We had a deadline of registering online or by mail. We saw thousands of voters getting registered at that point. But you're right, here in Washington State, we have same-day voter registration. So that means voters can get registered and get their ballot all the way up to and including election day. To help voters do so, we've got 7 vote centers across King County that will be opening up on Saturday, October 31st.
So if you haven't registered yet, but you want to, you can start doing that this weekend.
That's correct. And get your ballot. It's a one-stop shop and return it, vote it, and return it right there.
So you could just register and vote right then?
Exactly. Yes.
Whoa. Well, that's convenient. So are you expecting, are you prepared for lines if they develop?
We are. We have heated tents in the exterior of some of those vote centers. And all of the vote centers where we typically have been in the lobby of a city hall have all moved to event center style locations so we can ensure the safety of our voters and our staff. With social distancing, we will require masks and making sure, of course, to be using hand sanitizer, washing our hands, keeping everyone safe out there while they're voting.
I didn't know that. So if somebody hasn't even bothered to register, they can still go in starting Saturday, register to vote, vote, and they're done.
That's correct. Voters can come all the way up to election day. I certainly don't recommend that. You know, we also anticipate lines not only at vote centers, but at our drop boxes with nearly 500,000 voters scheduled to return their ballot on election day. Don't let that be you.
King County Director of Elections, Julie Wise. Good luck. Thank you.
Thanks. Happy voting.
Hey, what's your hurry? I see. You've listened to the sounds of the Pacific Northwest, and now you just can't wait to go look. Fine, but we had one more important sound we wanted you to hear.
Well, they were walking down the street. I never seen a couple young, fresh fellows before.
A few years before, the Seattle music scene exploded with Soundgarden, Pearl Jam and Nirvana. A certain pop quartet was one of the first local bands to be noticed by the national critics. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell is here to mark the 35th anniversary of the breakthrough album by the Young Fresh Fellows. Felix, brought to us by the King County Library System.
Hey, morning, Dave. Yeah, that was a Young Fresh Fellows theme we heard a moment ago from their first album. Now, the album that's now 35 years old is their sophomore effort. It's called Topsy Turvy. I spoke the other day with Scott McCoy. He's one of the founders of the Young Fresh Fellows. He's in his 60s now and lives in Portland. He's a veteran musician. He's toured with REM, played with all kinds of musical acts. But he's most closely associated with the Young Fresh Fellows, who launched in Seattle in the early 80s. Before that, Scott McCoy and the band's founding guitarist Chuck Carroll came to Seattle from the Bay Area looking to start a music magazine. Chuck had scoped out Seattle in the summer of 1979 and found there was nothing here like BAM, the free music paper in San Francisco.
So we just loaded up his Volkswagen van with all our records and guitars and just drove up there and found we had a friend of a friend who had a basement where we could live in and we just started doing it. And we, of course, we got up there, and in the 2 or 3 months that had passed since Chuck had been down there, the rocket had come out. So we get up there. The first thing we do, we went into the Rainbow Tavern just by a fluke. We walked in there and they had, you know, the second issue, the one with Clash on the cover. And it's like the rocket. We're like, oh, there goes our big idea.
So since somebody else had already started The Rocket, the late great music publication around here, Scott and Chuck got jobs there. Chuck sold advertising. Scott drove around in his 66 Cayenne Comet, collecting quarters out of the paper boxes for The Rocket's parent publication, The Seattle Sun. But they kept making music, and they put out the first Young Fresh Fellows record in 1984. It's called Fabulous Sounds of the Pacific Northwest. It added Tad Hutchison on drums, and they brilliantly used sort of vintage narration from a phone company promo record. That's what we heard at the start of the piece here. And Conrad Uno was a producer from Pop Llama Records. He sent it around the country to college radio stations, and it made a pretty big splash. But it was in the fall of 1985. It's 35 years ago. Unbelievable. Young Fresh Fellows released their second record, Topsy Turvy, and added a bassist, a guy named Jim Sangster. It was a hit here in the Northwest, and the big-time critics got wind of it, too. Now, Rolling Stone magazine really liked the Young Fresh Fellows. They listed the band's tour dates in the magazine in the spring of 1986. Now, I know to you whippersnappers out there that might sound insignificant, but it was a huge deal back in the pre-internet days, kids. Trust Grandpa on this one. Now, Rolling Stone critic David Fricke raved about Topsy Turvy in the July 17th, 1986 issue. Fricke said the Young Fresh Fellows were, quote, the perfect refresher, a bracing bop cocktail of daffy comic relief, canny pop songwriting, and punk rock drive. It was like gold. You know, the exposure sort of lit the fuse for the band, and many agree helped light the fuse for what became the Seattle music scene of the late 80s and early 90s that we all know and love. But all that attention didn't change things much in the near term for Scott, who kept his day job managing U District Record Store, Cellophane Square, or for the other members of the band.
We were looked at as being a really happening band in Seattle because we got national coverage, which nobody did back then, you know, because it was before all the Sub Pop thing happened and everything. So yeah, I mean, it was pretty cool for us, but we also had to kind of let people know, hey, it's not like we're big stars now. I'm still working at Cellophane Square and, you know, you'll see me walking around the Ave and we're going to play a gig for $100 or $200 at the Rainbow coming right up or something. You know, didn't really change us overnight, but it changed the perception of us overnight for sure.
You know, and 35 years later, it's still a great record. One of my favorite songs from Topsy Turvy is How Much About Last Night Do You Remember?
I wasn't going to get involved. I wasn't going to set myself up for another long haul. The feeling is that for my behavior and all the ones that I always end up hating when they're hanging on the wall. I knew you couldn't let me down. Couldn't let me sink into that battleground. But you look at turning back into the separate town. Thinking how much about last night.
You know, and it wasn't all hard stuff with the Fellows. There's a fair amount of Americana, kind of basic rock and roll on that record. Now, this is the live version of another track from Topsy Turvy, recorded at Seattle Center in August 1985, Searchin' USA.
And all my identity, baby, is blowing away with the wind. Don't know what I'm fighting, and that makes it much harder to win. So if people start asking about me, there's not much that you can say. Tell everybody I'm searching, searching USA.
You know, and Topsy Turvy helped lead to a contract with a bigger label in California, which meant more records and more touring. Fairly early on, original guitarist Chuck Carroll was replaced by Kurt Block. The band never made it big exactly, but they had some indie hits. They influenced a ton of other bands. They got to work with all kinds of other artists they admired. And like every other band at the moment, the Young Fresh Fellows are laying low. Scott McCoy had some health issues a few years ago, but he's doing much better. Before the pandemic, the band was still playing live dates, including in Spain, where they have a huge following. Wow. They also just put out a record that they recorded 3 years ago at Egg Studios, right before that was shut down here in Seattle. And that was the studio where they first did everything back in the 80s with Conrad Uno. The new album's called Toxic Youth, but for Scott McCoy, Topsy Turvy is still a big part of the band's DNA.
I just listened to it this morning when I got up, just to kind of refresh my memory. And it's a pretty strong record, you know? Yep. It's hard to listen to stuff that you did 35 years ago, but it sounds really good. It sounds really good. It's you can tell that that's a strong record because we still play a lot of those songs. You know, 35 years later, we still go back to that record and play them all the time. Really, you know.
Yeah. And well, that's great. Yeah. The life of a rock idol, huh?
Yeah, and 35 years ago this week, the Young Fresh Fellows played Lake Washington High School's homecoming dance, thanks to my friends Ken Zick and Amy Hunt. I think we're the only high school that can make that claim. So anyway, great band, still going strong 35 years later.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
One of the big questions that has dogged the Trump administration is whether the president is using his position as president to bail out his company. That's been David Farenthold's beat of the Washington Post. And yesterday, Dave, when we were talking to you, you mentioned that you had a new story coming out, and it has finally hit the web. And this is where you calculate how much the U.S. government is spending at his hotels. So tell me what your criteria were here for deciding which charges were due to Trump being president.
Well, that's a great question. So we got $2.5 million total of taxpayer payments to Trump property since Trump took over. And we tried as much as we could to figure out which of those were actually related to Trump's travel. At least half of those were. The rest of them come from the Department of Defense, who basically wouldn't tell us anything other than they spent money on certain places at certain days, but not why. So we're having trouble figuring out how many of those would have happened anyway, how many of those were related to Trump's properties. The ones that we care the most about, though, I think, are the ones where Trump has control over, where Trump basically steers the business to his property. Like one of the things we documented was his summits with foreign leaders at Mar-a-Lago. When he does that, his businesses reap tens of thousands of dollars from the government, charging them for catering, for flowers, for hotel rooms, basically every little expense, including in one instance, Trump's own water. Trump's business charged the U.S. government for Trump to drink his own water.
Okay. Now, for this to be something that would be compromising, wouldn't you have to prove that somehow this was like a sweetheart deal where the government was paying artificially inflated prices over what the most efficient choice would have been had, you know, the president not been the owner of a hotel chain?
Well, the comparison is probably the White House, right? That's the place where you would normally meet foreign leaders. That's the place where you would normally, you know, do these events. And so that obviously is owned by the government. So you don't pay anything for rent, to rent the rooms. And the people who would cater it are government employees. So it's hard to compare the cost because now you're taking something that's usually done by the government and doing it at a private.
So you're saying all these events could have been just held at the White House.
I mean, you could meet. That's the place where we talked to White House staff who said, like, not only would it be cheaper, it would be so much easier for us. Imagine the logistics of taking everything involving a summit with the Chinese president or the Japanese prime minister and moving it from the White House and where everybody works down to a club on a little barrier island in Florida. So, you know, it's logistically difficult. But the benefit for Trump is when he goes to Mar-a-Lago, he gets paid to cater his own summit. If he does it at the White House, you know, the government keeps the money.
Could you argue that some of Trump's properties are, in fact, more impressive than the White House? If the idea is to impress these foreign leaders and show them just, you know, how much respect we have for them, could you argue that it actually helps to have these things at a more elegant Trump property?
That's a great question. Trump himself makes that argument that, you know, when he had President Xi of China or Prime Minister Abe of Japan, he would say, well, you know, these places, everybody's just more comfortable here. We can make better deals at Mar-a-Lago. Without putting myself in the mind of Xi or Abe, it's really hard to know whether that's true. And if it is, if there is a marginal difference, you know, is it worth what we paid for it?
Hmm. One more question I have to ask you, not pertaining to your article, but you're from Texas, right?
Yes.
I keep hearing that Texas might be in play for the Democrats in this election. Do you think it is?
I do. I think it's more in play than it was in 2018, where Beto O'Rourke only lost by three, I think. The early voting numbers from my home county, Harris County, where Houston is from, from Austin, from Dallas, from the Rio Grande Valley, places that are big Democratic strongholds and have gotten only bigger and more blue in the last few years, the early voting numbers have been off the charts. So, I'm not saying Trump is going to lose Texas, but it seems like a 1-point, 2-point race at this point. And it's really hard to predict because there's a lot of people voting in Texas that have just not voted in recent elections. So it's hard to know how those people are going to affect the electorate.
Right. Pulitzer Prize winner David Farenthold, live from The Washington Post. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. Well, it's true here, and of course in many major cities, there are more people sleeping outside, be it in tents or just in doorways, to cut down on the wind chill. That's certainly true in Toronto, where Khalil Sievright thought, well, that's not right. And given his knack for woodworking, he decided to do something about it.
This is the window I've been using. It's just a basement casement window.
CBC News says he's building small wooden structures, the tiniest of tiny homes, just so a few more people can survive the elements. And if you think it's cold here, imagine how cold it gets further north in Toronto. That's why Khalil uses only the best materials for each of his tiny homes.
This is the normal bat insulation you would find in any house.
As the saws and drills go and he hammers and insulates, he's thinking about everyone he sees in the streets of Toronto.
I've never seen so many people staying outside in parks. And it's like, this is something I could do to make sure whoever's staying outside in the winter would be able to do it, like, survive.
The whole structure costs about $1,000 to build, 8 hours to construct, but he happily gives them away for free. He gave one to a man named Richie, who was living in a tent near Lake Ontario before getting a tiny home.
Yeah, he just started laughing, and he offered me money. He's like, how much is it going to cost? He said, how much is it going to cost? And I said, oh, it's people are donating money so I can do this, so I can give it to you for free.
We've heard homeless experts here anticipate a grim winter with more people outside, fearful of COVID-19 spreading in shelters, and more people homeless due to the economic crisis. Again, Seattle is not alone in this. Toronto's shelter system is strained, too.
It's going to be catastrophic. We have not yet seen the wave of evictions from people in unstable, unaffordable housing.
Khalil knows he's not solving the homeless crisis in his city.
This isn't a permanent solution. This is just like, make sure people don't die in the cold this winter somehow, at least some people.
But perhaps providing warmth through the kindness of his heart and the shelter of his homes will take some of the sting out of this dark winter. By the way, you don't have to build tiny homes to help. Just keeping extra gloves and socks in your car to hand to someone can go a long way.
And now from the Gian Ursula Show, which you can hear weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. And right now in the Senate Commerce Committee, the heads of Facebook, Twitter, and Google are providing virtual testimony. I'm seeing Mark Zuckerberg's face right now on whether they should be regulated because they've gotten too powerful and too arrogant. And, G., what do you think on this?
I just think, imagine your kids. So here, Dave Ross, you're at my house. It's myself and you and Colleen, and we're sitting there. And then my kids are going to come in, and we're going to talk to them about regulation of social media and all this stuff. And they have to sit there and explain all of the technology that we don't know and understand about the phones. So that's how I see this meeting going. Guys, for years, they've had a stronghold on all of this. I mean, it has influenced elections. It has gotten so big that I don't think we understood or even knew how powerful social media could get. I never knew that. I mean, I love social media, but I first got on, I got on Twitter in 2008. I think I got on Facebook in 2007. I had no idea. I thought I was just going to be looking at people's kids and pictures of animals and food. Had no idea that this would be turned into this right here. So you have all of the things that are going on with the social media side. And then, Dave, you also have the business side of things, like how much, like the big businesses, they're able to pay Google. Google is able to influence a lot of these things. So what ends up happening is these businesses make charge us more to help with that cost of Google. I saw it even with DoorDash when I was doing delivery service for 90 days. Guess which restaurants are able to be right there on the front screens? It's the restaurants with the biggest money. What ends up happening is the small businesses, they're down on the other pages, and so we might not order from them, and we get the better deals from the biggest restaurants.
That's capitalism, baby.
Absolutely. So
what do you want to see happen then? You want to see them split apart and regulated by the government?
I mean, do it. At some point, yes, Colleen, let's do it now. Or are we going to continue to wait for it to get even worse? Like, could you think about this? Can you imagine what this is going to be like in 10 years if there is no regulation? It's going to get even worse. Right now, we already are having small businesses that are just decimated because of COVID.
So you're worried about the advertising aspect of this. What about the information aspect? What about the use of social media by fringe groups to mobilize themselves?
Now, when you say the information, I mean, look how long it took for us to get people to get Jack Dorsey on Twitter to get a proof of information. So now, finally on Twitter, they're saying, hey, are you sure you want to quote tweet that? Did you read the article? You have that. And also they're kind of putting something on people posting fake things. So
was that public pressure, though, or was that really Congress questioning him?
I think it was public pressure.
Yeah, I mean, who needs the government to step foot into the Twitter wars, right?
And
let the free market decide.
And what you just said, Colleen, is money. You just said something that is so key. Who needs the government to step in? And that's the problem. The problem is the Jack Dorseys, the Mark Zuckerbergs. And by the way, Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook how? He was rating women. That's where it all started.
I know.
So this guy that was rating women with this Facebook deal in the Ivy League schools is now a big influence on the world. Like, in all fairness to Mark and Jack Dorsey, I don't think they really had that plan. I mean, I thought they thought things would get big, but I don't think they thought this. And that's the problem. They have more influence than our government. That's crazy.
That might not be so bad. G and Ursula coming up at 9 o'clock on Kai Radio. Thank you, G.
Guys. See you guys.
And one of the biggest issues on the statewide ballot this year, Referendum 90. This is the effort to repeal the mandatory comprehensive sex health education approved by the legislature. Sexual health education approved by the legislature. Here's a report from Kai Radio's Hannah Scott.
The bill to mandate comprehensive sexual health education led to packed hearing rooms in Olympia with overflow crowds, near thousands, and passionate testimony from both sides. In the end, it managed to pass, and the governor gave his stamp of approval. But almost immediately, there was a grassroots effort launched to undo what the legislature had done that culminated with Referendum 90 and the voters getting to make the call on this ballot on whether they want this controversial curriculum mandated to be taught to their kids. Mindy Wirth, the chair of Reject Referendum 90, the group trying to undo the mandated sex education for K-12 students. The issues for her?
Comprehensive sex education is actually teaching children, and in some cases, children that are too young to consent, how to say yes to sex. In fact, some of the lesson plans even encourage role play, where students are encouraged to judge how well, you know, kids negotiated sex. I mean, it's mind-boggling how this is considered, you know, an appropriate method for preventing sexual abuse, right? And in fact, you know,
and
so the mandate, I think, is just number one. And the loss of local control, the fact that this is unfunded, you know, there is no fiscal note associated with this bill, but we do know for the districts that, ironically enough, have opted out of not teaching sex ed primarily due to budget. And so we are now compounding the issue for these districts, as opposed to saying, like, let's set up a grant.
There are also concerns that go well beyond that, such as supplemental materials that can be sent home to parents, whether kids and, for that matter, all teachers are comfortable with this type of education.
Anatomically correct words that are intended to be taught to kindergartners, that is the actual curriculum.
But for the other side, including Senator Claire Wilson, an educator who championed this mandate, It's about something more important.
Number one, first and foremost, this bill is about safety. It's about giving students the knowledge that they need to recognize and resist inappropriate behaviors, from small children targeted by pedophiles to older students pressured to have sex by their peers.
And other supporters push back on the allegation about K through third grade kids being taught inappropriate material.
Identify how friends and family can influence ideas regarding gender roles and identity. Fifth grade, describe how media, society, and culture can influence ideas regarding gender roles. You know, it's pretty benign.
Worth admits that the most controversial content for those younger students is in the supplemental materials, but says there are also some pretty significant things in approved curriculum. In the end, she says this mandate is a mandate, which it shouldn't be, is confusing, can be changed annually, too hard for parents to find out exactly what their kids are going to be taught, and the one size fits all. She believes, as do others in the opposition, that this could be ultimately dangerous for kids. On the flip side, a new study just out shows this type of curriculum, in the end, is better for students.
And Hannah joins us live. So one size fits all. My understanding was under this initiative, it's doing is mandating that each school district have some sort of sex ed curriculum, which was not required before.
No, and it has to meet standards from the mm-hmm. that someone in the OSPE, the state school superintendent office, an appointee comes up with. So it's very specific type. It's very much about including, you know, gender identity conversations. Mm-hmm. There are conversations in the kindergarten through third grade where you do talk about body parts and things like that. The way it's designed, though, is that you have to meet the certain standards. Each district will choose their own curriculum, and it has to meet these standards that are on the OSBI site. Mm-hmm. And then there are supplemental materials that are allowed to be used as well that can be sent home for parents to work with their kids with. So that's what all of the
so
there's curriculum that is what they say. Yes, it
right.
is.
Now, and I understand, my understanding is in kindergarten there has to be one of these sessions.
Yes, I believe it's one for each K through kindergarten. There has to be one, and I think it's just one or two for kindergarten through third grade. It's not every year.
Yeah, okay. And then if the parents don't want it, they can opt their kid out of it, right?
They can opt their kid out of there. But my sense from the other side, who's trying to undo this law, is that they feel that it's not as easy a route as one might like if you wanted to.
Well, but this is the big question. So if you want to opt out, and I think that's great, parents should have that choice, do you have to hire a lawyer and swear out an affidavit?
No.
Or can you just tell the teacher, I don't want my kid in this class today? And that's that's a one-day class once during the whole year for kindergartners, and your kid doesn't have to go.
You can get out. It takes a couple of steps. There's just a couple of hoops you have to go through. You have to get a written form, and then you have to have it. It's not like notarized, but you have to go through a specific process at the school,
Is
I believe.
Is it more complicated than giving your kid permission for a field trip on the school bus?
I believe a little bit more. I believe there's one more step involved, but it's not, okay. Not terribly complicated. And then the other issue is that there's local control. That's the issue for the other side too. While the parents can opt out, the districts cannot, and not every district wants this. There are parts of our state where they absolutely don't want this, and they don't have that choice now. And it's an unfunded mandate. So that's the other interesting thing is if this doesn't go the way that the people who want to do away with this law, mm-hmm. want, there's the possibility that they may take a legal action and try to sue over this being an unfunded mandate, which we just got the first court decision on a week ago in a separate case where they said, yep, legislature, if you're going to make counties or school districts, whatever, do this type of thing, you're going to have to give them the money. And they didn't in this case.
Mm-hmm. Now, the censored words in those spots for this referendum, are these obscene words?
I believe they're anatomically correct body parts is what she told me. So
they're body part words.
Yes, okay. I believe so. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
curriculum.
How else would you teach sex education unless you? I mean, I'm an old guy, and I believe in the one or two sex ed classes we took, they used the actual words for the body parts as opposed to, what would be the options? Slang? I mean,
But what grade were you in? So this curriculum that's in those spots where they reference the body parts is young. It's either K through three or it's fourth grade. So it's much younger than, I mean, I didn't get that kind of a class until I want to say 14.
I guess what I'm saying is the kids already have words for these things, which are usually not the standard anatomical words. So, I guess I just don't get why those anatomical words are a thing.
They, for some people, they feel like it's too young. And then, you know, one of the other big things is that there's not every teacher is comfortable teaching this curriculum. And there's concern that not every kid is going to be comfortable being taught this. There, you know, kids are in different situations in the state, whether, you know, their home life, maybe they are already abused in their home life. And there's all kinds of issues where it could trigger someone who's been through abuse before, that kind of thing. So that's why there's this concern about the one size fit all, where it has to meet these specific standards where they talk about these particular things. But as I mentioned at the end there, there's a new study here out of the Journal of Adolescent Health that says the research into this comprehensive sexual health education, which is a very specific model, found that it not only lowered youth pregnancy and sexually transmitted infection rates, it also prevents domestic violence and sexual abuse and improves healthy relationship development.
All right, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet. You can ring my
bell, ring the bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The pandemic has forced some people to do a complete 180-degree turn in their careers. Here's Rachel Bell.
For the past 15 years, Seattle's Leslie Saber has worked as a professional photographer.
Events and weddings, big corporate events and parties, 100% of that business has dried up.
Now she's a terminal attendant for the Washington State Ferries.
I started training March 16th, which was the day of the shutdown. And ever since then, the world turned upside down. But actually, instead of 180, it was like a 360 for me, because I found where I belong, and I found great people to work with, and a job that's different and exciting and interesting every day.
The excitement is not hyperbole. 2 weeks ago, lightning struck a ferry in Edmonds while Leslie was on her shift.
We had a pretty exciting thunderstorm come through Edmonds. The clouds started turning dark. I went outside to take a picture because photographer. And then the person on the boat said, oh, there was just some lightning that was horizontal. It looked really cool. And so I kind of stepped towards it to see if I could get a picture of the lightning. And a moment later, the world exploded. It was a body blow of sound. So the lightning bolt hit the tunnel and knocked me off my feet and slammed my knees to the ground.
Leslie learned her lesson that day. Don't walk towards lightning, Leslie. But I'm still going to trust her now that she's offering advice for others who might also be going through a tough career transition.
One of the things that I embraced is the fact that what I do is not who I am. Our culture really does define us as what you do is who you are. So that has really helped me reinvent.
Since 2011, Brittany Bartoladen has been the head pastry chef at Dahlia Bakery and Tom Douglas Restaurants, which was basically her dream job.
On Fridays, I would go home excited because it was my weekend. And then on Mondays, I would go in excited because it was my Monday and I'm starting my week. It was pretty great.
But in March, Seattle chef and restaurateur Tom Douglas made the decision to close all of his restaurants.
We were all laid off. It was a temporary thing. It'd be about 8 weeks. But he also made it pretty clear, like, he didn't know. And they had no idea what this was going to turn into. When Jay Inslee gave those stay-at-home orders, Tom had to ask himself, like, are we essential? Are pastries essential? Not really. Our bakery was tiny. It was impossible to be socially distant. And so it was the right thing to do. I knew it was the right thing to do as much as my heart was broken.
After spending some time on unemployment, Brittany got antsy and started looking for a new job. Now she is the production manager at Metropolitan Market. She does still manage a kitchen, but she no longer bakes.
I would say I am still in mourning. It'll take me a while. It may never go away. There is always going to be an ache to create desserts. But having said that, I don't know that I would ever want to go back to the restaurant industry. It's a very unstable industry. The margins are so slim. I mean, this pandemic was unprecedented, but leading up to it, it definitely felt broken. And it felt like really anything could come along and upend the industry. And so I do feel like I've shifted to something much more stable.
For the first time in her career, Brittany works Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. She loves her coworkers and the culture of the market. But losing her identity as a pastry chef has been the hardest part.
100%. I would say that's the biggest part of this. It's like, who am I without this? Being a pastry chef was part of my identity. I had been doing it since I was 19 years old. I'm now 40. It was such a huge part of my life. And yes, the ego is huge. Like, I don't have a pretty picture of a plated dessert to put on Instagram anymore. There was a certain notoriety that you gain when you're a pastry chef working for a successful restaurateur like Tom Douglas.
But Brittany also offers advice for those looking for a new career right now.
Like, if a good opportunity comes along and it feels right, take it. And while you're learning the job, which is what I've been doing and getting comfortable there, find out what's going to make you happy. For me, it was going back on the radio and baking at home and keeping a foot in the industry a little bit. Ask yourself, what will make you happy? And if there's nothing about it that will make you happy, then maybe it's not the right thing for you.
So the radio program that Brittany is referring to is right here on Cairo Radio. It's Tom and Terry's cooking and food show called the Hot Stove Society Radio. And Leslie is also still taking pictures, mostly now of sunsets and fairies. And you can see one of them at mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell.
They'll never lose their talent, though, right? A talent for photography and a talent for being a pastry chef is something that will come in handy from time to time, won't it?
Exactly. You know, I think a lot of people say, you know, don't get a job doing your passion because then it's never as fun if you're making money off of it. So maybe they can go back to enjoying their passions, even though it seems like they both really loved what they were doing before. Luckily, they sound happy doing what they're doing now.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.